Welcome to Torati Mechanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Liat Meyerfeld, and today we are learning Melachim Aleph, Chapter 15. The dog ate my homework. I'm ill with food poisoning. It's not you, it's me. These are all great excuses and sometimes work. One of the first rules in public speaking is not to start with excuses. No one wants to hear you if you preface it by telling them you're sorry for not being able to prepare properly. But today my excuse is valid. If today's chapter seems disjointed, it's him, not me. The Book of Kings till now had a pretty linear narrative structure. Even in the last few chapters as the kingdom split, there was a clear progression of events to follow. All of that is out the door with chapter 15. The text attempts to tell the story of two separate kingdoms simultaneously. The result is a confusing jumble between different kings and different time periods and different interactions and stories. Perhaps the book written this way is a reflection of the chaotic nature of the split kingdom. What was once one nation is now split into two different kingdoms with diverging trajectories, all in a relatively short period of time. We'll try to make sense of it. With many of the kings in both kingdoms, we hear about them in a standard recurring format. A king will be acknowledged for all his meritorious deeds, if any, and a caveat will follow to the effect of his sins, and if he followed in the ways of King David to worship Hashem. We also will get a state of the union, the relationship between the northern and southern kingdoms during his rule. We start with the kingdom of Yehuda. Aviam, son of Rechavam, is king after his father. How is he? One of the worst. And he walked in all the sins of his father that he had committed before him, and his heart was not at peace with Hashem. And if that is not enough, throughout his reign the war continued between them and the kingdom of Israel. Horrible. If not for Hashem's promise to David and Shlomo, Hashem would have removed him from the throne a long time ago. Aviam died, and Asa, his son, reigned after him. According to verse 2, Aviam's mother was Ma'acha, daughter of Avishalom. Yet when he died and was succeeded by his son Asa, we read in verse 10 that Asa's mother was also named Ma'acha, daughter of Avishalom. The Radak explains that Ma'acha was not Asa's mother, but his grandmother, and since his grandmother raised him, she can also be called his mother. We are told that Ma'acha is the grand wizard of idol worship, so to speak. And here the famous expression Bubamisis originates. Asa didn't believe his grandmother at all and did not follow in her Bubamisis. As a pleasant surprise, we read, and Asa did what was right in the eyes of Hashem. Finally! What did he do positively? Asa brings gold and silver from his father's treasury and uses it in the temple, as that is the focus of his kingship. He destroys all the idol worship in the land and takes brutal public measures against his grandmother. He strips Ma'acha from her royal status of queen mother. She is no longer a practicing royal. Cannot use her title in any correspondence or publicity, loses her state funding, and her patronages are stripped of any support. Asa cuts off Ma'acha's miflezet that she had constructed by an Asherah tree known for idol worship. I interrupt this program with a quick public service announcement. Speaking modern Hebrew is an incredible concept. For an ancient language to survive and be revived into daily colloquial speech is historically unheard of. This is the power of a holy language. Having said that, we remember there was much controversy over using modern Hebrew in daily speech, as it's holy, and many thought it should only be used for Torah learning. One of the issues we do encounter is that Eliezer ben Yehuda and his counterparts who established modern Hebrew used their Torah knowledge and took words as they wanted to understand them and incorporated them into modern Hebrew. Perhaps most famously, the word chashmal is found in Yechezkel's esoteric prophecy of the Merkava. We don't know what it actually was, but it's used in modern Hebrew for electricity. Ma'acha's idol is called a miflezet. In modern Hebrew, this has been taken to mean a monster. In our verse, some commentators do describe it as a scary, grotesque structure. Rashi explains that miflezet is a combination of two words, meaning extreme sexuality, and explains that it was a phallic-shaped structure which she had daily intercourse with. Asa cut off this structure from the tree and burnt it in the Kidron Valley. The contrast between Aviam and Asa with their shared background highlights each individual's power to choose. Aviam rejects his ancestral father, emulating instead his immediate father and mother, while Asa chooses to reject those influences and remains wholehearted with Hashem all his life, like David, his great-grandfather. With each generation, we're reminded that heritage can only take one so far. Every individual will have his own influences, challenges, and personality. Each is held accountable for his choices, to live up to his yichus and promise or not. It is glaringly obvious that Yirmiyahu is not writing a history book. Many major events are ignored here, but we are privy to a peculiar addition to our understanding of King Asa. In Asa's old age, he was stricken with a foot ailment. This is not just your average cracked heels or bunions. We hear that his foot ailment was exceedingly great and rose from his feet to the rest of his body. This is maybe a mida keneged mida punishment for taking the scholars out of the Bet Midrash and having them participate in construction. He didn't appreciate their Torah, which is one of the legs, the foundations that the world stands on, so his own feet were stricken. In Divrei Hayamim, we learned that Asa did not seek help from Hashem for this disease, but from medical professionals. The Jewish philosopher and rabbi, Bachya ibn Pekudei, in Spain in the 11th century, in his influential work on the inner spiritual life, Duties of the Heart, states that Asa's going to doctors shows lack of faith. If he had called out to Hashem, he would have been healed. We know that Asa did turn to Hashem in prayer and holy sacrifices many times before battle. On the other hand, in other battles, he trusted an enemy, Aram, to fight for him. Asa's foot ailment reminds us of the hair's breadth balance between bitachon, faith in Hashem, and hishtadlut, putting in our own efforts. The depth of bitachon is faith that everything that occurs to a person is directly orchestrated by Hashem. Nothing happens randomly, nor can anyone do anything to an individual unless it is Hashem's will. Our efforts can only come with this recognition. On a certain level, when Asa asked Aram for military assistance in battle, it shows he thought Aram had the power to win for him. Since he pretended he didn't have legs to go to war, he suffered from a foot ailment. What is this battle and war of which we speak? The war between the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Yehuda continues. This time, the focus of the war is on territories and borders. Yehuda has been experiencing years of religious and civil stability with King Asa's link in the Davidic chain, providing legitimacy. It seems many people from the north migrated towards Yehuda, since the northern kingdom was filled with problems. More on that later. Baasha, the king of Israel, wants to stop the exodus from his kingdom and begins to expand his borders towards the south, trying to encroach on the territories of the kingdom of Yehuda. In order to make sure that his people don't leave and that Yerushalayim starts to collapse, he builds an outpost and controls all exits and entries to Yerushalayim. A country cannot survive a blockade dominating your travel and commerce, as that in essence takes away your liberties. We know from recent history how difficult it is to break through a stronghold around Yerushalayim. When his own military responses aren't effective enough, King Asa takes drastic measures. He transfers silver and gold to the king of Aram, which is now Syria, and says to him with complete transparency, "I'm sending you this bribe of silver and gold. I think it'll be worth your while to break your agreements with Baasha, the king of Israel. Come from the north and fight against him, and free me and my kingdom from him." The king of Aram takes the money, attacks the kingdom of Israel, and captures some of their territories. Distracted by his problems in the north, Baasha abandons his campaign against Yehuda. Peace is restored to Yerushalayim. They say you can't buy love, but you can pay heavily for it. The political-military alliance with Aram is certainly effective, and Israel's attacks against Yehuda cease. But at what price? King Asa is considered a good king, but he has sold his brothers in the northern kingdom to the enemy. King Asa, king of Yehuda, died. It was certainly a dramatic reign, and after him rules his son Yehoshaphat. But wait, before moving on, why did it suddenly say that Baasha is the king of Israel? Wasn't it written in the previous chapter that Nadav, the son of Yerovam, is the king? So now the chapter jumps back to catch us up on what had been happening in Israel in the northern kingdom. Well, Nadav really was king after Yerovam, and he reigned for 2 years. How was he? And he did what was evil in the eyes of God, and walked in the ways of his father and in his sin, and made Israel sin. Then Baasha conspires against him, that is, rebels against him and kills him. Who is this Baasha anyway? He's an outsider from the tribe of Issachar. But when Baasha kills Nadav, he eliminates the kingdom of the house of Yerovam. And it came to pass, as his king smote the whole house of Yerovam, he did not leave any soul to Yerovam until he had destroyed him according to the word of Hashem, who spoke by the hand of his servant Achiah the Shiloni. This liquidation of all the males in the house of Yerovam is the fulfillment of the prophet Achiah's curse. It was actually common ancient and not so ancient practice when someone usurps a royal house. Turkish sultans, Japanese and Zulu leaders, one recalls Macbeth's impulse to kill Banquo and any of his offspring in order to eliminate anyone who might lay claim to the throne. And this is how Baasha came to rule. Besides each kingdom having their own internal issues, we see this second story that flows through these chapters, the civil war between the south and the north. Perhaps most disheartening is this disintegration, that they don't merely agree to part and go their own separate ways. No, again and again we are told that their paths now erupt into full-blown warfare. There was war between Aviam and Yeravam all the days of his life. And we are told twice in two different places in this chapter, there was war between Asa and King Baasha of Israel all their days. Is there no midway point between complete unity and utter warfare? Are those our only two alternatives? Apparently, in the animal kingdom, in most instances, unless there's a mingling of populations, shared intimacy and offspring, then the general result is violence and death. This is true for lion prides, for ape populations, and according to anthropologists, seemingly also for human communities. Getting along is literally a matter of life and death. If this is so, then the daring experiment of democracy is a radical way to institutionalize disagreeing without erupting in chaos and murder. Here, the disagreements and the potential reconciliation are of course rooted in Torah. The selling of Yosef embeds a tragic divide amongst the Jewish nation and sets the stage for the terrible split of two kingdoms. Rehavam, king of Yehuda, is from the tribe of Yehuda, and Yeravam of the northern kingdom of Israel is from the tribe of Ephraim, son of Yosef. The Yosef-Yehuda rivalry for firstborn status has resurfaced in the ugliest of ways. However, the prophet Yechezkel's vision of reunited kingdom at the time of Mashiach is our northern star. In facing this challenge, our response holds the power to shape our destiny. History bears witness to a pattern weighted heavily towards tragedy and ruin. Yet, we wield hope, steadfast principles, and the wisdom passed down through generations. Let the missteps of our ancestors echo as an inspiring call. The ultimate imperative is to live together, and in that way, to choose life. Thank you for studying together. Lilui Nishmot Imoteinu Yekarot, Esther Oppenheimer, Alea Shalom, and Sarah Schenker, Alea Shalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.